thanks for inviting me. So this is some work I've been doing with my student Adam Clark, and yeah, we are working on some supersymmetric extension of the Janus solution. It should be clear from the title. So what is our motivation for doing this? For one, what we're going to have to deal with is our ADS4 warped compactifications of type 2B, which are supported by a 3-form flux. And we thought it's kind of good to get to know as much as you can about those. There's lots of supergravity technology available for finding ADS4 slice supersymmetric domain walls in 5D gauge supergravities, but none of them so far had been used in string theory, and we're kind of asking ourselves, where are they, right? And whenever you have some useful supergravity tool, it's almost for sure going to have some role to play in string theory. And well, of course, I also have some history on this. We want to complete our earlier work on Janus, kind of doing something which is against the usual spirit in ADS-CFT. We start with a completely non-supersymmetric theory, and we want to deform it in such a way that it becomes supersymmetric again. We want to make sure that ADS-CFT still works if we turn back on supersymmetry. And there was one nice upshot which kind of we didn't anticipate. We find one curious ADS-4 solution which seems to be a compact space times ADS-4 supported by fluxes in type 2B. Dilaton seems to be frozen, and we would have a field theory dual for that. But there's still some subtleties about this, and I was hoping to get some feedback from the audience on how to proceed on this one. All right, so what is Janus all about? Before we do super Janus, we should do Janus again, right? So all my transparency is going to be cut. So the spirit behind Janus was something you could have done right after ADS-CFT was discovered, right? You look for solutions of type 2B supergravity, which is supported by a 5-form flux because you want to have something like ADS-CFT, and you turn on one more field. The easiest thing you could think of is kind of, well, let's try the Dilaton first, right? So write down an ansatz for your metric, ds squared e to the 2a, and you write some warp product, you have some 4D metric, you slice up your ADS-5 or the ADS asymptotic ADS-5 like space by some metric GIJ, which you take to be Minkowski, the sitter-4, ADS-4, whatever you like. And you write down some domain wall like ansatz where the only field that's turned on in addition to the metric in the 5 form is a Dilaton. And of course, people have done this, right? The first one I think who studied this in a little bit detail was Steve Kupfer. He came up with this paper on Dilaton-driven confinement. We basically studied the flat slicing version of this. And the problem with those solutions is they have naked singularities. Gravity breaks down. So what the way you wanted to interpret this is that there's some trace F squared vacuum expectation value in the field theory. That's probably not even, you can't just turn on trace F squared in the field theory. This is not one of the moduli. There might be some time-dependent solutions close to that, which might make sense. But to begin with, there's no reason why you should study this theory anymore. It was something where gravity didn't really get you anywhere. And people indeed have studied, have stopped studying it for quite a while. And then a few years later, there came a big surprise when Bakgut, Perl, and Hirano kind of revisited the whole issue and said, well, if instead of using Minkowski or De Sitter or whatnot, you use ADS-4, which just sounds like one more option. But if you use ADS-4, you get a smooth, stable, non-supersymmetric solution of type 2B supergravity, and that's what they call the Janus solution. And they call it Janus because of this feature that it has two boundaries. If you plot the warp vector, you have something that goes to the UV boundary on one side, it smoothly turns around, shoots back off to the UV boundary again on the other side. And the Dilaton, what does the Dilaton do? The Dilaton looks like a domain wall which interpolates between one value of the Dilaton on one side and the different value of the Dilaton on the other side. Doesn't look like an RG flow because you basically go from UV to UV. What is the interpretation of all this? Okay, the reason why we got, yes, you.
I was going to ask for a Penrose diagram, but maybe you're getting
it. Soon. I'm not drawing Penrose diagrams, but I'm trying to explain the geometry, which I think these drawings are probably. So the reason why I get into this is because ADS-4 slicing of ADS-5 is something I have worked on before that quite a bit. And ADS-4 slicing of ADS-5, if you now first start with pure ADS-5, right, to understand what you're doing, then kind of ask in what sense did Janus deform this. If you just take pure ADS-5 slice in terms of ADS-4, that's something which has a natural interpretation in terms of a defect conformal field theory. And the way to see this is just ask yourself, how does the ADS-4 slicing of ADS-5 look like? So this blue ball is supposed to be a sketch of ADS-5. We're looking at this at constant time, so this is then you think of 85 as a big cylinder with a gravitational potential pulling everything to the center. That's one time equals constant slice of this big cylinder. This S3 out here, so I draw an S1, but that's an S3 if you want to do 85. It's the boundary of the 85, just the center of the 85. This is how the 84 slices look like. So if you slice 85 and 80, in terms of 84 slices, you naturally seem to be getting two boundaries, even so they're both just half of this S3, which is the boundary of 84. So you have half S3, one hemisphere sitting at r equals plus infinity, the other hemisphere sitting at r equals minus infinity. Or the way you really get out the boundary, if you use as your defining function this warp factor, then you would get your boundary being two copies of 84 pasted together at their common boundary, which is conformal to S3 times r to the usual boundary of 85. So all you did here is you take the usual 85, but divide it in a way which naturally splits it up in such a way that the boundary seems to be split in two parts, so that half of the boundary sits at r equals plus infinity, half of the boundary sits at r equals minus infinity. Yes?
These solutions really are black holes in the bulk, right?
Right now I'm talking about pure 85. This is pure 85.
But pure 85 with ADS4 slicing,
yes,
describes a black hole, right? The natural time, at least you can
choose
the time translation symmetry, which has a horizon.
This doesn't have any horizon anywhere. This is.
You're not going to use that. Okay.
Pure 85 and this 84 slicing, the warp factor is a cosh, right? There's no. If I use global ADS4 on the slices, this is a coordinate system which covers all of ADS5, doesn't have any horizons. It's a different global coordinate system in ADS5. So it depends on what coordinates you use in the 84. But if you use global coordinates on the 84, this covers all of. These are all my slices, right? They cover all of ADS5. It's a global system, ADS5, no horizon around. If I do this hit a slices, I would hit a horizon. But these ADS slices, I don't. And I cover all of ADS5. Anyway, so what we studied in the past was the D3D5 system, which is a slight modification to this, where basically in addition, you put in a D5 frame, which is wrapping S2 inside the D5, but would be stretching on one of these ADS4 slices inside the ADS5, and therefore makes use of the structure that it kind of is sitting at the point where the left half of space gets split from the right half of space. Going to talk about this in the field theory in a second, just to remind you what this was in the field theory. Just let me contrast this with Janus. What Janus is doing, basically, Janus is asymptotic ADS 5 times its 5, and basically only significant deviation from ADS 5 times its 5 you have in the center region. So you take something which is almost like ADS 5 times its 5 in ADS 4 slicing, but then you modify the warp factor a little bit in the center, and the stress energy that supports this twinkling around with the warp factor in the center is some dilaton gradient where the dilaton goes from one value at the right to a different value on the left. Okay, so what was this in the field theory? Let's start with pure ADS5, right? Pure ADS5, we all know what the dual field theory is supposed to be. It's n equals 4, but the way it pops up in this ADS5, in this ADS4 slicing of ADS5 is you have the n equals 4, where you kind of separate it into the n equals 4 that's living in the right half of space and the n equals 4 that's living on the left half of space. The right half of space is sitting in r equals plus infinity. The left half of space is sitting in r equals minus infinity in your gravity. And they are connected together via this x3 equals 0 line. And this is the way it popped out of the gravity. And what the ADS4 slicing does for you, it makes an SO3,2 subgroup of the SO4,2 conformal group manifest. And that's obviously the right subgroup to describe a field theory when you kind of separate the right half and the left half, because SO3,2 is a subgroup of the conformal group that leaves the given line x3 equals 0 invariant. So if you study the full n equals 4, of course, you have more symmetry. You have the full SO4,2. There's a translation invariance across this arbitrary line, which I introduced. There's no physics associated with this line. We do the n equals 4. But if you think of the n equals 4 starting out like this now, you can easily see how you modify the system if you add, say, if you go to the D3D5 system. For the D3D5 system, what you do is you start out again with the n equals 4 superimages living all over space. But what you now did, you added some extra matter on this x3 equals 0 slice. And as long as you make sure that this extra matter describes the 3D conformal field theory, in the case of the D3D5 system, this would be a free hypermultiplet in three dimensions, which indeed is a 3D conformal field theory, kind of a trivial one. Mm-hmm. And you couple it in the right way to the n equals 4 superimages, and this system is still going to preserve the SO3,2 symmetry, even so now it is going to break the translation variance in the x3 direction. And that was the dual field theory to the D3D5 system. And similarly, you can come up with a dual field theory for the Janus theory. the dual field theory for the Janus theory. And I talked about this half a year ago here already, but let me just remind you about this. The dual field theory for Janus would be something where you have the Enkel force of the Mills with one coupling constant on the left, a different coupling constant on the right, but there's no new degree of freedom living on the interface. You just take your good old N equals 4, you write it down with one coupling constant on the left, you write it down with a different coupling constant on the right, and that's it. Right? The field theory is perfectly fine. That's your Lagrangian, you write it down, you study it. It's very much like a dielectric interface. If you write down Maxwell's equations with a quarter f squared with a 1 over g squared out front, then what this would do is kind of introducing a different dielectric constant for your electromagnetic field on the two sides of the interface. And
it's singular in some sense at the interface, or no?
You can, right? So this is what I'm going to talk about a lot. If I write down my action now that I broke translation symmetry, you might wonder, can't I now add new terms which are localized in the defect, like before this 3D hypermultiplier that's really living on this defect only? I'm going to add terms like this later, but certainly these are all different field series which you can study, and they'll all be, they have different properties. And you can calculate things about this. So one thing that's now going to happen this year, we'll have one-point functions. You can say calculate the one-point functions of the Lagrangian of any gauge invariant operator you want on the left-hand side and right-hand side. And most of them will have some non-vanishing one-point functions now, where the one-point functions all had to vanish if in the full n equals 4 to begin with. Okay, let's say a few things about supersymmetry from this point of view of the field theory. Supersymmetry is completely broken by the interface, and it's quite easy to see from the field theory. So remember, the standard SUDI law is that if you look at the variation of the Lagrangian and the supersymmetry transformation, what's usually going to happen, in particular what's happening in the n equals 4, it's not that the Lagrangian itself is invariant, but that the Lagrangian transforms into total derivative. Then usually say, fine, because it's a total derivative of something, the action is invariant because the action is an integral over the Lagrangian. But now if you put in a coupling constant in front of your Lagrangian, which depends on the position, then of course you're no longer fine, right? So you can integrate by, I do my supersymmetry variation, the Lagrangian varies to give me the derivative of something. I integrate by parts, so I get something times the derivative of 1 over g squared. And for us, I'm always going to use it as 1 over g squared, the position-dependent coupling constant, at least in the first 90% of the talk. I'm only going to use step functions for my 1 over g squared, so then the derivative gives me a delta function. So supersymmetry is broken on the defect because, or on this interface, the variation of the Lagrangian can be integrated by parts into something which only lives on this defect. So supersymmetry is explicitly broken by putting in this interface.
The fields are required to be continuous across?
The boundary conditions you impose on the fields, you can look at the Lagrangian and you're going to get some, the propagators have a partially transmitted term and a partially, yeah, they're continuous, but there will be some reflection. So if you write on the propagator, it will always have a direct term and it will have a mirror term from some image charts sitting on the other side. It's really like E&M, standard E&M, which you would study in Jackson's textbook or whatever textbook you like, because most people don't like it. But okay, what this discussion was supposed to suggest is that SUSY could be restored by adding new defect localized terms just of the sort you were asking me about. Right? I just told you supersymmetry is broken, but it's really only broken by a term that's completely localized of the defect. So why don't I add some new terms to the defect, some new counter terms, we call them, even so they're not counter terms in the technical field theory sense, just some new terms in my action, which would have the effect that the variation of those new terms, so now they explicitly come with a delta function, and I don't want those to be invariant under supersymmetry, but I want those to transform just into something which kind of compensates for this supersymmetric non-invariance from the bulk from the, we call it the ambient space in order to distinguish it from the bulk ADS, which I also was talking about. And with Friedman and Schnabel, we already found that if you are not so ambitious and only insist on restoring two supercharges, then here are some counter terms to do the job. Basically, you have something which is cubic in the scalars, but more interesting, you get something that's like a gauge genome mass, and it's proportional to it. So this is the C derivatives of the coupling constant, so you can think of this as being a delta function. this works, this counter term works for any kind of position dependence you want to give your coupling constant. And so you can add these counter terms in order to make the field theory supersymmetric to get two supercharges back in the field theory. The price you have to pay is you have to pick out who's your Gugino. You used to have an SO6 or SU4 invariance, which rotates all the Gugino, all the fermions into each other. The supersymmetry restoring counter terms break your global symmetry from SO6 down to SU3, which is why in this paper with Schnabel and Friedman, we only put this into the appendix because we are really mostly interested in the Janus solution. And the Janus solution itself has SO6 invariance, has no supersymmetry. This is also obvious from the gravity side. It's quite easy to check on the gravity side. There's indeed no supersymmetry left. And we use this counter term argument to basically convince ourselves that there's no SO6 invariance supersymmetric field theory. So that kind of made us happy because it made this identification more obvious by this. I mean, you didn't want the supersymmetric interface theory dual to a non-supersymmetric gravity. So you have a non-supersymmetric gravity theory dual to a non-supersymmetric field theory. What's remarkable about this was that this is a stable non-supersymmetric background of type 2B string theory. All supersymmetry is gone. The stability was established by Friedman, Nunes, Schnabel, and Skinderis using some Witten-Nestor-like positive energy arguments. And the reason why I write quotes around rigorously is because even so, it's not just small fluctuations, it's global in the sense that they prove positive energy theorems. They have to make some assumption about what's happening on the S5. So if this were a 5D theory, it would be rigorous, but because it's a 10D theory, they have to assume that there are no instabilities hiding in some higher Kaluza-Klein ones.
So there's a parameter, which is the amount by which the dilaton changes.
Yes.
And that can be as long, I mean, is there, that can be.
Actually, okay, this is something I didn't want to talk about, but there's, remarkably, there is a maximum value this can take, and we have no understanding whatsoever on this from the field theory. Then a naked singularity develops. That's one of the puzzles about Janus, which hasn't been addressed from the field theory side at all. Okay.
So this argument you just mentioned, positive energy theorem. So they show that this Janus solution is the minimum energy configuration among all solutions that.
Yes.
Do something, but have these boundary.
They use kind of they define some killing spinners, right? And
spinners. There's no supersymmetry.
But you can still, right? Witten's positive energy theorems didn't require supersymmetry. They just require that you can, out of some pi spinner, you can produce some energy, some tensor which you can use to define energy, which you then can prove is bigger for all other configurations.
This does minimize the energy in some.
Yes, it minimizes. If you only study the 85 and if you take basically n equals 8 gauge supergravity and you throw away all the higher Kaluza-Klein modes, then you can prove it's the lowest energy configuration. If you don't do that, then if you don't throw away, so the quotation marks are about throwing away the higher Kaluza-Klein modes on the 85. In any case, a different way to say this has to be stable. So we have a dual field theory and the we have a non-perturbative definition for this, and so it better be a good background of string theory. Now you can doubt, well, to what extent do you really know that ADCFT still works when supersymmetry is gone? And one other surprising feature about Janus was that even so all supersymmetry is gone, you still can compare things meaningfully between weak and strong coupling, because even without supersymmetry, there are still some non-memorization theorems that are alive. And at first it sounds crazy till we told you to draw Joe told us why it's not crazy. And then we checked it, and he was right. This can be understood using conformal perturbation theory. If you think of this Janus theory as being the n equals 4 with some coupling constant, which is the same everywhere, so what you just have called the n equals 4 in the good old days, now you perturb it by some perturbation, which is again the same Lagrangian, the same n equals 4 Lagrangian, but now with a step function. So I separate my coupling constant, the average coupling constant, and the jump. Then you can treat it as a perturbation. So now I can do conformal perturbation theory. I expand out my path integral, and then I get that. Say if I want to calculate, and that's the one thing which we calculate in great detail, the one-point function of the Lagrangian in the theory with coupling constant lambda. So now I go from g squared to lambda because we do some large n limit. So then to leading order, I just get the one-point function in the n equals 4, which is 0 because the n equals 4 doesn't have any one-point functions. And then the first correction to this is some small coefficient gamma, which parameterizes the jump, times an integral over a two-point function of two L's, and then the next term would be a three-point function of L's, four-point function of L's. And this guy is a protected two-point function in the N equals four. And in conformal perturbation theory, you calculate all your correlators in the original theory. So this is a supersymmetric theory which has all the non-normalization properties. And so the leading order gamma contribution to the one-point function of the Lagrangian is protected to all orders in lambda, to all orders in the Toff coupling. And you can calculate this from the gravity side by staring at the gravity solution. You can calculate it from the field theory side. You get a number out, and the number agrees on both sides with all the pi's and the 2's. So that was one nice piece of evidence that these two theories are actually dual to each other. And you can check some things even through supersymmetry scan. So this was all the summary. Let me summarize what I have done so far. This is all the old stuff. So I told you, I reminded you, hopefully, the Janus is a stable non-supersymmetric background of type 2B string theory. The dual field theory is known. It's a defect conformal field theory with a trampling coupling constant. And despite supersymmetry being gone, some correlators are protected. And in the field theory, 2 plus 2 supersymmetries can be restored at the cost of breaking SO6 down to SO3. And I call it 2 plus 2 because we still have conformal symmetry, right? So I mean, two supersymmetries appear in the Lagrangian. They get doubled to 4 because it's conformal. And so this SO6 breaking but supersymmetry restoring counter terms involve the Gugino mass, and then I would call it a super partner, even so it's not obvious how the supersymmetry structure relates those two. Right, so now you can ask yourself the obvious question, and that's what we basically asked ourselves, and that's what's the departure point for this project is. If from the fields we know that by adding a new term to the Lagrangian, which is SO3 invariant, I can restore supersymmetry, what is this on the gravity side? This should be possible to kind of ADCFT, I believe, whatever perturbation I add on the field theory, it should have some correspondence on the gravity side. So I should be able to add a perturbation on the gravity side to Janus, which suddenly makes Janus supersymmetric. So adding these counter terms, and you know what Gugino masses are dual to. Gugino masses are dual to a three-form flux. So by taking this Janus solution and turning on some three-form flux on top of it, you should be able to make Janus supersymmetric. Another way to see this is, of course, gravity alone knows about the same thing, right? If you look at the Dilatino variation has a term which is proportional to the gradient of the scalar field, so usually they get hidden in this PM, but really this is just some linear combination of the axion and the dilaton. And Janus wasn't supersymmetric because it had this non-vanishing dilaton derivative which wasn't canceled against anything. But it's clear that if you turn on a three-form flux, if you turn on the right three-form flux, there's some potential to cancel off this varying dilaton. So how to find the solution? This sounds like a complicated problem to begin with, right? But SO3 invariance is actually quite restrictive, and we want to have SO3 invariance be our guide to get there, right? And in addition, we want to make use of the fact that this lambda field is in the n equals 8 gauge supergravity. So if all we want to turn on is the scalar field dual to the lambda operator is a field in the n equals 8 gauge supergravity. So that should be enough to study if we want to find the solution. So the only thing we need to study is we have to look for a Janus-like solution in this theory, which has 42 scalars and a complicated potential. That sounds horrible, but it's still much easier than studying the full 10-dimension theory, at least so we believe. So otherwise, we would have to pick a metric on this internal space, which is no longer going to be an S5, and we have to put the right three forms on this internal space. All right, so but this is if we really were to take arbitrary perturbation, right? We know we really want an SO3 invariant perturbation. So in order to make use of this fact, what you want to basically do is find all the scalars which are singlets under SO3. And that gets rid of most of those 42 and gets you down to a manageable set. So if you ask yourself, how do the fields of this n equals 8 gauge supergravity transform under SO6? Here, the well-known content. You have two singlets, which are the dilaton and the axion, and they are dual to the operators F squared and FF dual in the usual way. Then you have a 10 and a 10 bars. That's where the three forms are hiding. And those are dual to the fermion masses. In addition, you have the 20 prime, which is kind of all the rest. And those are dual to most of the scalar masses, to the traceless scalar masses. So that's the SO6 content. So already on the SO6 invariant level, you had two scalars which you could turn on, the axion and the dilaton. Now we want to know how many more scalars do we get if we restrict ourselves to the SO3 invariant subsector. So if you just look at those representations and ask yourself, how do they decompose under SU3? Well, two singlets become two singlets, right? That wasn't too hard. The interesting thing is that the 20 prime doesn't give anything new. If you look how the 20 prime decomposes under SU3, you just get sixes and eights. Out of the tens, you get two more singlets, and yeah, that's a gate genome mass, right? There's a complex gate genome mass or a magnitude in the phase of the gate genome mass. And so one of those comes out of the 10, the other one comes out of the 10 bar. So in this SU3 invariant subsector, all you're left with is four scalars, and if you check the vectors, there's one vector there. So this can all be nicely summarized by now an n equals 2 gauge supergravity with a single hypermultiplet which lives in this nice famous coset space SU2, 1 mod SU2 times U1. So what we end up having to study is ADS4 domain walls, curved ADS4 BPS domain walls in this theory, which is n equals 2 gauge supergravity coupled to a single hypermultiplet living on that coset space. And just to remind you, that's the right amount of SUSY also for what we have in mind. So on the field theory side, what we had a wall. The wall, this interface, breaks half of the supersymmetry in n equals 1 down to 2, but then I got two more from the superconformal. We now compare this to a supergravity theory where we look for a BPS domain wall in theory with 8 supercharges, so the BPS domain wall has also 4 supercharges. So I get 4 supercharges to 4 supercharges. All right, so I hope this led you to understand that what I want to study is the SU3 invariant subsector of the n equals 8 gauge supergravity and study BPS domain walls in that theory. That sector actually had been studied before, and the story here is almost like with this dilaton-driven confinement before. People studied it, and the only thing they did is they put this flat slice domain wall in there. And Pilch and Warner were the first ones to do this. Distler Zamora write a paper about this. And basically, their conclusion was it's boring. Distler Zamora found a non-supersymmetric solution, which they want to interpret as being some non-supersymmetric confined gauge theory, but it has a naked singularity. And Pilch and Warner were just happy with saying, well, there are no interesting supersymmetric walls in that theory. So it was discarded, and people moved on to what they consider to be more interesting theories. The next thing you can do, the next more complicated one, is go to the SU2 times U1 invariant sector. The less global symmetry you have, the more scalars you get, right? With SU2 times U1, you have 5 scalars. So in addition to the hypermultiplet, you have to now throw in a vector multiplet. You have to gauge a second U1. And then what's hiding in there is this, the famous Friedman-Gupta-Pilch-Warner flow. So one of the most exciting RG flows in ADCFT you can get in this framework by putting in a second writer, putting in one more scalar going to this SU2 times U1 invariant subsector. But what now we thought we need to do is to revisit the SU3 invariant subsector, but this time allow ADS4 sliced BPS domain walls as opposed to flat ADS, flat sliced BPS domain walls. Unfortunately, there's already a lot of technology out there doing that, and that's what I mentioned in my introduction. There's actually so much technology out there that you really should have wondered to begin with, what is the use of all this in string theory? Curve BPS domain walls in n equals 2, d equals 5 gauge supergravity have been studied in a series of really quite remarkable technical papers by Bernard Svetichin, Cardoso, Dalagata, and Luz studied the curved BPS domain walls, and they're all relying on a paper by Cheresoli, Dalagata, Kalosh, and Van Prooyen on how to write down the most general gauge supergravity in 5 dimensions coupled to hypermultiplets. I'm not going to spell out the whole formalism for you, just the one main player in this whole game is an SU2 triplet of free potentials. And what this SU2 triplet of free potentials does for you, it tells you what isometries of the hypermultiplet moduli space did you gauge. So it's a gauge supergravity. You start with some global symmetries in the game. The global symmetries are, for example, the isometries of your moduli space. This SU2,1 mod SU2 times U1 has lots of isometries, and then you have to specify 3 functions on that moduli space which tell you, encode the information about what are the killing vectors which you actually gauge when you go to the gauge supergravity from the ordinary supergravity. And it, like a superpotential, you get relations which, for example, in the end express the scalar potential in terms of those P's, where you split up the P into W, which is at magnitude, and the Q is its phase, and you get some complicated expression. Just wanted to tell you that, like in the gauge supergravities you're probably familiar with, once you have these pre-potentials, everything else is determined. So then, in order to find BPS domain walls, the first thing you have to write down are the supersymmetry variations of your fermion fields. Right? You start with a gravitini. So a gravitini variation is you have some covariant derivative which picks up some new connection part. And in addition, you have something proportional to these pre-potentials. And where these IJs are SU2 indices. And all your spinners have SU2 indices. So your spinners always come in some SU2 doublets. And this triplet of pre-potentials is by using Pauli matrices. You can also write down by a bunch of 3 2x2 matrices. Right? So when I write PIJ, I just contracted my prepotentials with polymatrices. So this is a gravitino variation. Then you can also write down the hyperveni. People use some unpronounceable Greek letter for those. And again, you get something which only depends on basically the metric on the hyper-multiplet modulized space and which directions did you gauge. So now the information gets packaged a little differently in the standard literature. So you have the field binds in the quaternionic hyper-multiplet modulized space, and then you have these n objects which again have the field bind and then have the killing vectors directly. But basically all those things are known once you have the metric and once you specify which directions to gauge. And let me not get too much into these details. The one more thing which you need is once you have your supersymmetry variations, you want to make an ansatz for what are the preserved killing spinners in that background. So we look for a solution where we have only radial dependence, and let's call the radial direction the 5 direction. Then you want to make a projector ansatz where I, gamma 5, epsilon I. Well, in the flat casing, all you really need is to put epsilon I on the other side. What we now do is we allow ourselves a projector, which kind of is some random SU2 rotation. By random, I mean you even make this SU2 rotation dependent on the radial direction. Why do you do this? Well, you can't solve it if you don't. And you have this freedom. You have an SU2 verse of spinners. So you have to make an ansatz where as you move in this radial direction, it's a different SU2 component of the spinner that's preserved. And the way you write an arbitrary SU2 matrix in this game, one way to make it quite manifest is you put the phase of the superpotential in there with some prefactor, and then you add some other matrix, MIJ, which is some matrix depending on the field, but with some other prefactor, B of R. You want this M to be a phase, so it has to square to 1, and you want it to be orthogonal to the Q, so you can meaningfully pull out that piece. So these M's really parameterize one free function of the fields. So there's one free function of the fields which tells me, goes into the ansatz for my preserved supersymmetries. Once you have this, you can write down your flow equation. There's some work in there, but all you go through is standard technology to go from the supersymmetry variations to some first order differential equations on the bosonic background fields, which then become the flow equation that determine the background. So unfortunately, people started calling this, I tried to use a notation of those papers, Lust and Co., because it's complicated enough that I don't want to have to deal with translating their formalism into some new language. And they made this choice of calling A the prefactor of Q in the projector. So now suddenly you have to go to a notation where the warp factor is no longer A because there's only one A in the game. So my warp factor from now on will be called U. So the metric has an e to the 2U out front. And the coordinate is called C just because they don't do it. So this notation will everybody, whoever worked in Wendel syndrome, will feel a little uneasy in the tummy calling something the C coordinate, even though it's what should be the R coordinate. And the warp vector is U, but that's the way it is, just to follow their notation. And then here you get the flow equation. Get a flow equation for this warp vector. This A is determined, B is determined, the scalars are determined. There's some function gamma around which involves this superpotential and the warp vector itself. There are two independent sign choices, which turns out to be important if you actually want to find planets, but let me not go into the details of this. And so you have all your flow equations. Now you only have to pick the M's, and then you can go ahead and solve it. So, well, you actually need more. What we've identified so far is we have found the SU3 invariant subsector of the N equals 8. There are 4 scalars living on that particular coset. So we know the metric on the hyper-multiplet moduli space. That's what's implied by writing down the coset. We know one isometry is gauged. But what we need to know is we need to know those prepotentials. Right? We need to know what are the prepotentials associated with the particular gauging. The gauging, there should be one unique gauging of this particular hyper-multiplet moduli space that's sitting in the N equals 8 gauge supergravity. You can do lots of different ways of gauging this space, but only one of them is going to sit in the N equals 8. So one way to do this is to start with the N equals 8 and look at the complicated supersymmetry transformations, the N equals 8 gauge supergravity, try to figure out which one is the right one by carefully doing your truncation. What we're going to do is we're actually going to do the same as those famous people. We're going to cheat. When they looked at the SU2 times the one invariant subsector, what they did is instead of going the way down from the N equals 8, which they didn't even want to do either, even so they spent all their life worrying about gauge supergravities, what they did instead is they looked at the most general U1 gauging of the hyper-multiflat moduli space, and it turns out there's a unique one which has all the right properties to be possibly sitting in the N equals 8. And that's what we're going to do as well. So instead of doing the truncation explicitly, we look at the most general U1 gauging of this coset space has 8 isometries, so there are 8 U1s which you might want to gauge in there. And it turns out, again, there's a unique one that has right properties to correspond to the n equals 8. By the right properties, I mean the right fixed point structure. Let me be a little bit more explicit about this. So here's one metric you can write down on this coset space. There are 4 fields, V, sigma, R, and alpha, which will feature a lot in the rest of my talk. And of course, you don't see a metric to this. Right, so here's a metric. You probably don't care about the metric anyway, so let me move on to this. So what's interesting, so there's a field R, which I later want to identify with the magnitude of the gauge enum mass. And at R equals 0, you have the potential is independent of V and sigma, and you have a 2-parameter family of ADS5 maximum of this potential. And that's what we know we have to have in the n equals 8. What the n equals 8, among other things, is supposed to describe is the ADS5 times this 5, our beloved one, in which you have the dilaton and the axiom free to vary. If you choose any other gauging but the one which I'm going to use, what you end up is you end up isolated fixed points, isolated ADS5 fixed points, where there are no fields free to be varied anymore. So this identifies uniquely, and the U1 which you gauge is actually a quite trivial one. It's the one where you send alpha to alpha plus constant, where alpha we would identify as the phase of the gauge enum mass. And that's the unique gauge that gives me the right fixed point structure to correspond to the U1 gauging of this moduli space, which is sitting in the n equals 8. So that has to be the right one. And this identification of V being the dilaton, sigma the axion, R the magnitude of the gauge enum mass, and alpha the phase of the gauge enum mass, they are really only trustworthy at this fixed point. Right? When I'm at this fixed point, I know V and sigma parameterize a flat direction, so I want to call them dilaton and axion. And R is the thing, is the magnitude of what takes me away, and alpha is the phase of what takes me away. So I know that the 3 forms of the gauge enum masses, in the other words, have to be proportional to R. Once I'm away from the fixed point, this might all get mixed up. In particular, we expect the 10D dilaton to depend on all 4 of those fields. And that will become important later. But I'll still keep on calling them dilaton, axion, and magnitude of the gauge enum mass in the rest of the talk. Okay, let me say this once more, just so, because the last slide was a little technical. Here's it in words. So there's only one gauging out of those 8 up to global symmetry transformation. So there are some equivalent gaugings which all basically give rise to the same three potentials. That gives rise to the desired fixed plane. All others would give me fixed points instead of fixed planes. And what this method gives me is gives me the right action, the right supersymmetry variation to study. The one problem with this procedure is that if you want to go back to 10 dimensions, which we very much would like to, it complicates it because some step we didn't really truncate down, but at some step we just construct by uniqueness, try to go back up. So if I really want to read off my 10-dimensional solution, which I constructed this way, I'm going to have a hard time because I can't just take Pilch-Warner formulas and plug in because I don't know how to write my things in terms of n equals 8 language. In any case, now I have the right equations to solve. So these are the flow equations describing the flow of those 4 scalars and the warp factor 4 scalars in the SU3 invariant subsector of the n equals 8 gauge supergravity in 5 dimensions. And at least you can write them down in half the transparency, right? Here's the flow for the dilaton axion gauge in the phase of the gauge enum mass. This still doesn't sound that nice, right? But remember, there's still this M floating around. So I still have a free function M of all the scalar fields, which I can put into whatever I want, which was parameterizing my answers for what supersymmetries I want to preserve. It's a matrix M, or I write it as a vector up here, but it really had this property that it has to square to 1 because it was supposed to be a phase and had to be orthogonal to the free potential. So there's really only one free function you can choose. You can choose, say, M3 as a function of R, V, sigma, and alpha, and then you can go and solve your flow equations. So now we can try to make use of the choice to find simple flows where not all 4 scalars run, but only some of them. So you can always choose M so that one scalar is constant, right? You switch off one of those alpha primes by just choosing M such that the right-hand side vanishes. But what's more complicated, or if you make special choices, if you get lucky, you can turn off 2 or even 3 scalars. And at least we haven't found a good way to classify this. But one nice choice to set 2 fields to be constant is choosing M such that sigma and R don't run. So R was a magnitude of the, this must be wrong, this must be alpha and sigma that don't run. The phase of the gauge enum mass doesn't run, and the axion doesn't run. And that's precisely what we wanted for Janus. And then, surprisingly, you found also different choices. You can make three fields to constant, where the only thing that varies is the phase of the gate genome mass. And that will give rise to this curious ADS solution, which I want to talk about at the very end of my talk. But let's make first do the first choice. So by choosing the right M, I can write down a set of first-order differential equations where only the dilaton and the gate genome mass run, the magnitude of the gate genome mass. And now we have some tractable sort of first-order equations. So we have two first-order equations for the two scalars, and then there's a third equation which gives me what the warp factor is doing. Actually, it turns out again that precisely the same sector, the same model has been studied before by Cardozo, Dall'Agata, and Lüst, and they just called it a toy model. They said, well, if I want to make use of our complicated formalism to describe BPS domain walls, why don't I start with this simplest hypermultiplet space and gauge the simplest U1 gauge and get sitting in there and just look what I get. And the problem with their approach was that because they didn't know that it's supposed to correspond to Janus, they didn't really know what to look for. And then they specified initial data at infinity and found a curvature singularity in the IR. And then they thought, well, that's probably not the most interesting example. If you know what you want, if you know you're supposed to look for Janus, then you don't just want to start with the UV and kind of just use some arbitrary integration constant, right? These are first-order differential equations. If you start at infinity, you can choose the value of V, the value of R, and then you integrate in. And then most of the time, you get a curvature singularity. If you know what you want is Janus, instead, what you want to do is you start in the IR. You say, well, let's find Janus, right? Set the warp vector u prime equals to 0 at 0, and dial u so that you get the right answer. And then you find, actually, u prime can be 0. And it can be 0, surprisingly, only in a quite small window. There's a factor of 1.25 times whatever coupling constant you chose in order to do your gauging, where e to the minus u naught can live so that you can solve this equation, u prime equals 0. But once you solve this equation, you can just numerically integrate out these three differential equations, and you find nice ADS5 asymptotics. So I brought you plots of those. So this is how the warp vector looked like. And I got inconsistent myself, right? We went back to the good old A, but this is really what I called U. This is a warp factor and the Janus solution. So the warp factor does what it's supposed to do. Out here, that's basically a Koch, even so you might not recognize it as such. But this is ADS5 out here in the middle. It's kind of stretched out a little bit. If you plot the non-supersymmetric Janus next to it, you probably would almost not recognize it, at least if you dial your parameters right. The dilaton does what it did in Janus. It kind of comes from one value asymptotically on one side, goes to a different value asymptotically on the other side. And in addition, there's the three form turned on. I call it the gate genome mass and kind of abusive notation, which is 0 far away from the defect and peaks on the defect. So this looks right. This has all the properties to be dual to Janus and has right SU3 symmetry. So we thought this is enough to conclude that part of our story and say we constructed super Janus. We constructed a curved BPS domain wall of the right n equals 2 equals 5 supergravity. And we identified it with being the super Janus field theory via the global symmetry. We believe on both sides we have essentially found the unique SU3 invariant supersymmetric version of Janus. In order to check this a little better, it would be desirable to once more calculate correlators. We've already done this on the field theory side, but on the gravity side we have this complication that so far we only have a numeric solution. It kind of sounds wrong that on the field theory side I can calculate things analytically, so we want to kind of stare a little harder on the gravity side of whether we can get the analytic answers from there as well, and maybe once more compare. Since things agreed in the non-supersymmetric case, they shouldn't get worse once I make it supersymmetric. But, so far, the supersymmetric case for sure looks more complicated than the non-supersymmetric one. Okay, let me spend my last 10 minutes to talk about this curious ADS4 solution. So I told you before we had identified a few choices of this M, which parameterized my supersymmetry projector, which made the equations particularly simple in the sense that I could turn off more than one scalar. The one I used for Janus was one where I turned off two scalars. There was a different choice for M. They can actually turn out three scalars. The only thing that's running, the only thing that's left running, is the warp factor and the phase of the gate genome mass. So in particular, now, if you ask yourself, can I choose u prime to be 0 at 0, you find, yeah, you can, but then it vanishes identically. If you choose an initial condition where u of naught is given by this, and then you find u prime vanishes identical, identically, and alpha is this, it's some r cotangent of something exponential. So what you get here is a solution, which as a solution of the 5D gauge to the gravity is AdS 4 times r, and the only thing that vanishes along this V-line is the phase of the Gugino mass. And it shifts by a quarter period from going from all the way on the left to all the way on the right. Actually, if you look at the Friedman and Co. paper, they already identified some similar solution to this in the non-supersymmetric case with the dilaton running. If you just study gravity, it's actually true that if you have a negative cosmological constant in the scalar field, it's quite easy to support AdS 4 times r geometries. AdS 4 times r with the scalar running in the r direction is a solution of just the simplest gravity plus negative cosmological constant plus scalar field. So it's not that amazing if one finds this. It's intriguing that there's a supersymmetric version out there, because then you feel, and this is a supersymmetric version in the subsector, it's really the SU3 invariant subsector of type 2B string theory, so you believe that this should mean something, right? This AdS 4 has some role to play in the AdS EFT story. So now we try to think a little bit about what role it has to play. And a lot depends on how this actually looks like if you write it as a 10D metric. And here's what we believe is going to happen. And let me run the story past you, and you tell me whether it sounds believable to you. So we believe what's going to happen if we uplift is that this, what looks like an R, actually is going to be an S1 in 10 dimensions. And this depends on the hope that the 10D metric actually involves this alpha field, that that what looks like an R line actually is an infinite distance measured in the 10D metric, but only turns out to be finite distance in the 10D metric. So I can put these four of those solutions together where my axion shifted by a quarter of a period to get an S1 where the axion shifts by 2 pi around. If this is true, well, then the 3 form has to be SU3 invariant. I turn on n units of 5 form flux to this compact space. The dilaton is fixed. The axion is free to be whatever. If this is the right picture, then it comes with a dual gauge theorem. Right. If this is the right picture, and you would naturally think what the dual gauge theory should be, is the 4D n equals 4 CPR mills reduced to 3 dimensions on a circle, where you take the limit that the radius of the circle goes to 0. The coupling constant varies around the circle like a sine. The Gugino mass varies around the circle like a cosine. By the formalism which I showed you earlier, it's quite easy to show that that setup would be supersymmetric. Whether it's conformal, I don't know. I don't even know how to calculate anything in that theory at the limit where the radius of the circle goes to 0. But that's what we hope will turn out the story to be. But there might be other options to this. But we certainly found it curious that this AdS 4 is sitting there. And it would make much more sense to us if once I uplifted the 10 dimension, this R actually becomes an S1. But this is mostly a hope at that point. Okay, let me conclude. Didn't take me 10 minutes to get my last point across. So here are the things which I showed you, that starting from the Janus, a super Janus, Janus solution can be constructed by turning on a supersymmetry restoring deformation. This whole solution makes heavy use of this technology that has been developed in supergravity to find curved supersymmetric domain walls. So far, they had only limited connector strings here. I hope at least this will be achieved in making this connection strong and showing that they're actually useful for some things that are relevant in AdS 15. In the process of having done this, we uncovered a curious AdS 4 times R solution, which we hope might be a good candidate for finding one of those flux stabilized SUSY AdS 4 vacua, which are so popular these days, for which one actually knows a CFT tool. But okay, this is not a complete story yet, the second transparency of my conclusions. Thank you. Yes, good.
It's not Calabi-Yau. So the usual constructions that people do are actually using Calabi-Yau. This is somewhat.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a Calabi-Yau anymore, right?
Something compact, but it's not a Calabi-Yau. So
if
it's really an S1 times something.
There's something, should be some SU3 invariant metric you put in the S5. Right? This wouldn't be a Calabi-Yau, no. But it's supersymmetric, that much, right?
Yeah, so.
What the n equals 8 gauge to gravity really does for you, right? It guarantees you this is going to be a solution of type 2B string theory. It's going to have that amount of supersymmetry. It's going to have that particular global symmetry. So, and yes, so this. This is out there, right? So there's at least an 84 times R times compact out there. There might even be an 84 times this one times compact out there. And it's supported by three-form flux. So usually what people do is start with a Calabi-Yau turn on three-form fluxes and preserve the supersymmetry, right? But this would be something where you start with non-Calabi-Yau and you turn on three-form fluxes and together they're somehow supersymmetric, right? That,
yeah, there's a classification some type of structures you get.
Yes, yeah, so maybe it's all, maybe what you're telling me is that this R never can become compact. But I would like to see this in more detail.
I wasn't saying that. Maybe there's a solution out there people have found for
some. So we found some two old papers which kind of Dan's paper cited, which themselves only had one citation, which was Dan. And they claim to find in type 2B some solutions which had the form 84 times internal space, where internal space is some harmonic space, but they claim this could never be supersymmetric, but they haven't really got around to compare their analysis with ours. It's a different language, right? They really start from 10D, whereas we want to kind of start with 5D. We know what we're starting with. We're starting with this gauge supergravity, which describes the SE3 invariant subsector. They kind of guessed what the internal space had to be, and they only put homogeneous spaces there. So maybe it's not a homogeneous space.
Okay, I guess I have another question about this ADS4 plus R. So the solution you have actually has two boundaries, which are two copies of ADS4, right?
Yes.
Go to R and both ends.
So, but that's already true for ADS5 itself, right? If you take ADS5 itself in ADS4 slicing, it has two boundaries, both of which are ADS4. And the way this works, the way why this is still the ADS5, which only has one boundary, is what you have one ADS4 here, you have the other ADS4 there, and they talk to each other across their common boundary. Two ADS4s pasted together across their common boundary are related by a conformal transformation to, say, the sphere times R or Minkowski space, which is the way I used to phrase it. So you can take Minkowski space and conformally transform the left half of Minkowski space to one ADS4, the right half of Minkowski space to the other ADS4. And then so if you have Minkowski space and take the left half and the right half, you know how they communicate. You send the signal in from the left, it just keeps on going to the right. Now you impose the same bounding conditions on the ADS4. From the ADS4 point of view, this sounds wicked. You have some, usually when you send some light signal in the ADS4 to the boundary, your natural reaction was to say it kind of bounces back to me. Now what it's going to do, if it hits the boundary of ADS4, it's going to go to some other ADS4, which is beyond my universe, goes around the whole ADS4, and then comes back in my universe from the other side once it traverses the other ADS4.
But I guess my question was, in terms of your proposed lift, in which this R becomes an S1,
yeah,
in a dimensional space, you don't have these two copies. You just have ADS4 across some compact space. So I don't see how that's quite
right.
How can you have...
Okay, so sorry for the 84 times R, probably what I should say is, but if I write on 84 times R and I use this naive Witten's description of what the boundary should be, then I take the metric, I multiply something which has a function which has a quadratic zero in whatever coordinate approaches the boundary, and that's my boundary metric. If I use that prescription, the R factor would completely disappear, and I would just see a single. Well, you're saying I still see two 84s. I don't see 84 as a boundary anymore, right? My boundary is going to infinity within the 84. It's not going to infinity in this radial direction. If this radial direction doesn't compactify, another version would be to kind of claim this is something like a little string theory where people had kind of this duality where they take Minkowski space times linear dilaton is dual to something which is a little string theory where the infinity are really the way you go to infinity along this real line. Yeah, in my prescription, I was now claiming that going to infinity, I would really only do within the 84 space, and this R factor just completely drops out, becomes part of the internal space. Sorry. Yeah.
More questions?
Another question.
Yes.
So in the previous paper you wrote on the non-supersymmetric case, when you computed one-point functions, you said that you used the conformal perturbation theory, where you have a very small gamma for the deformation, and you compute higher point functions, as corrections to the undetermined case. But then you say for n-point function for n greater than 4, they're not perfect.
Yes.
And then, so it would seem to me that it only works for some very small value gamma, presumably. And if so, can you check that using this?
So it depends on what works, right? What we would say is that duality will work for all values of gamma, but we can only check the order gamma term in small n endpoint functions. And that kind of, we saw it's convincing evidence that at least whatever you can check works. Even the n equals 4, you can't check all correlation functions you would like to check, right? If you go to non-BPS operators and calculate the correlation functions, you even the n equals 4 theory, you can't compare weak and strong couplings. So yes, we have a little less than in the n equals 4 because it's like a few like one-point functions, two-point functions you could in principle check. And we really only check two one-point functions, one of which was 0, so you might not consider it a big check. And the other one was this one-point function of L. So there's one number. But it was one kind of weird number. It's not like one or two. It's something like pi over 27. And it was one weird, wicked number which agreed on both sides. It's better than nothing here, but it's...
But would it be better here, is my
answer? It should be better here, yeah. So that's why I'm so annoyed by this fact that the gravity side seems to be much harder once I reintroduce supersymmetry, but just because I have more scalar fields to introduce. In the non-supersymmetric case, you can just analytically solve the solutions. You write down what your dilaton field is, you just integrate the equations of motion, and you get the solution, you read off the asymptotic behavior, you get all these correlation functions with the pi's and the 2's. Whereas now all I have is this numeric solution, I have to somehow extract the coefficient of the exponentials from the numerics, and I get something which is just some decimal number, right? And I have to compare this to something which has 2's and pi's in the field. So that's why I still hope we can do better. There should be this. We haven't found an analytic solution to those equations yet, but
yeah. Yeah, but you made an answer, right? Some
things
were zero.
Yeah, but so we found a choice for M which can set two fields to constant, and you didn't have any reason to expect that anything else but the Gaugenian mass and dilaton are going to be turned on. So it's already kind of reassuring that indeed there is a. So usually by choosing M, you can only set one field to be constant. It was reassuring that there was a choice of M which could actually set those two fields which you don't want to zero. So what I wrote down for you is the solution of the equations promotion. Yeah, it could be that there are other equations where, in addition to, say, the phase of the Gaugenian mass also varies from one side to the other. I don't see any reason why it should happen. There might be that this is a different solution, which then that there's more than one supersymmetric Janus out there. That could happen. What I gave to you is certainly the simplest solution. It looks like Janus. It's sitting within this context, and it seems to have all the right properties. So we stopped looking there, but it's not a no-go theorem, that there are no other more complicated Janus-like solutions hiding in this. I mean, certainly turning on the axion in addition doesn't do anything else, because then I know what I want to do in the field theory, right? In the field theory, I can make Seder jump because of the main wall too. That's something you can do. You can write down Janus-like solutions for that, can study it. That's certainly a different solution. I knew from the field theory that I have that freedom.
So there's a plan to get a thin ring.